Now, ladies and gentlemen, meet the press. Ready for this spontaneous, unrehearsed conference are four of America's top reporters. Please remember, their questions do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It's their way of getting a story for you. Here is this evening's moderator of Meet the Press, NBC commentator Ned Brooks.
Good evening and welcome once again to Meet the Press. The Harry Dexter White spy case has stirred up a great deal of commotion. It's one of the bitterest debates in recent years, a debate certain to have profound political effects on both political parties. Last Tuesday, after former President Truman made his address to the nation, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI and the Attorney General, Mr. Herbert Brownell, were questioned before the Senate Internal Security Committee, known as the Jenner Committee. As the chief counsel of that committee, our guest tonight, Mr. Robert Morris, led the questioning. And tonight his position is reversed. He will do the answering. By way of introduction, I think I should mention that Mr. Morris recently was elected as a judge of the municipal court in New York City. And Mr. Morris, all of us congratulate you and wish you the very best of luck. Seated around the press table tonight, ready to question Mr. Morris, we have the representatives of the three press associations: Mr. Jack Bell of the Associated Press, Mr. James Lee of the International News Service, Mr. Lyle Wilson, the chief of the Washington Bureau of the United Press, and Mr. Lawrence Spivak, the regular member of the Meet the Press panel. And now, Mr. Morris, if you're ready, I think we'll let Mr. Spivak have the first question.
Mr. Morris, the accusation that Mr. Brownell made in his speech in Chicago was that former President Truman appointed Harry Dexter White, even though he knew he was a spy. Do you think that the testimony of Mr. Brownell and Mr. Hoover before your committee proved that charge?
Well, you're asking me now, Mr. Spivak, to make a final conclusion before all the evidence is in on that particular case. But certainly, in view of Mr. Truman's speech and in view of the testimony given by Mr. Brownell and Mr. Hoover, certainly he had all the reason in the world to know that Harry Dexter White was a spy.
Now, you've seen a good deal of the evidence that was known in 1945. As chief counsel, do you think there was enough evidence in 1945 to prove beyond reasonable doubt that Harry Dexter White was a spy?
Well, it's evidence that would satisfy me, Mr. Spivak. It's so impressive that I think I would be satisfied by it if I were to read that.
There was one part of the speech of Mr. Truman's that I wondered about. He said, "This report showed that serious charges had been made against White, but it pointed out, now the report pointed out, that it would be practically impossible to prove those charges with the evidence then at hand." Have you seen the report?
Well, I've seen some of those reports. You'll notice, Mr. Spivak, that Mr. Hoover stated that there were eight security memoranda forwarded to the President of the United States during the period of about 4 months from the end of 1945 through early 1946. And each one of these eight mentioned Harry Dexter White. And also, in view of the facts that were brought out about Harry Dexter White, together with the fact that, remember, notes in his own handwriting had been turned over to Whittaker Chambers, and Whittaker Chambers produced these papers some years later.
Yes, that didn't come to light.
No, that's right. That came later.
What
you had principally, as Mr. Hoover pointed out, or perhaps it was Mr. Brownell, that there were 30 sources of evidence and information concerning Harry Dexter White in the reports that I've alluded to. There were 30 different sources.
Did you see the report?
Oh, no, I haven't seen anything more than what Mr. Brownell and Mr. Hoover have testified to.
And you don't know whether the summary that of the report that Mr. Brownell gave your committee had in it the words that it would be practically impossible to prove those charges?
No, I haven't seen that expression used at all, Mr. Spivak.
You think it would be important to find out whether that report that he summarized had those words?
Well, I think, in knowing what we know now, that it would have been possible to prove that evidence.
Mr. Wilson.
In 45.
Yes.
Mr. Morris, may I call you judge?
You may, Mr. Wilson.
Well, this is a judicial question.
That's probably more than you'll get from any other member of the panel.
Very likely. In speaking of reasonable doubt, isn't there a difference between reasonable doubt? I'm asking your opinion of this.
I understand.
Reasonable doubt as to the fitness of an individual to hold public office, and reasonable doubt as to the propriety of convicting him under a criminal statute.
That's a good question, Mr. Wilson. The issue here, it seemed to me, certainly from the security point of view, was whether or not this man, Harry Dexter White, in view of the very impressive evidence and information that was then available, whether or not such a man should be retained in government. Now, mind you, Harry Dexter White was only one of many. I mean, altogether in the Bentley combination, there were 80 undercover communist agents, 37 of whom were in the United States government. So the question of security risk is entirely different from that of producing enough evidence to bring about an indictment and a subsequent conviction.
Mr. Bell.
Was Harry Dexter White any more important than several others in this alleged espionage ring?
Well, it's hard, Mr. Bell, to determine who was the most important one in it. I would say there are 7 or 8 people in that ring who are obviously very high-level people and well-entrenched within the Soviet organization as it operated. Now, who of those was the most important, I don't know. I would like to call your attention, however, to the fact that Harold Glasser, about whom we've had much testimony, and who himself appeared before the subcommittee, appeared to be the strong man selected by the Soviet overlords to watch Harry Dexter White to see that he kept supplying all the information and everything that was necessary to carry out the Soviet purposes.
Was Alger Hiss a member of this group at that time?
Well, if you recall, Elizabeth Bentley has testified that there were 4 rings that were operating in government to her knowledge. Now, 2 of these she could identify and make clear the makeup in its entirety of the 2 of them. Of 2 others, because she did not actually supervise the other 2, she could only tell us sketches from these particular rings. That's the 2 other rings. One of these, one individual in one of the second 2 rings, was said to be Alger Hiss. At least Elizabeth Bentley has so testified.
Well, why was the Harry Dexter White case singled out at this time for public presentation? Do you know?
That you'd have to ask Mr. Brownell, I think, Mr.
Well,
Bell. I wouldn't know.
Was the Attorney General working in connection with the committee at the
time he made
these charges?
He was not, Mr. Bell, and I think at this point I should point out that the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee has been carrying out this particular series of hearings since last April. Generally, during the last 3 years, under a Democratic chairman, Senator Pat McCarran, and now under a Republican chairman, Senator William Jenner, the subcommittee has been trying to determine the extent of Soviet penetration of our own government. Since last April, with great particularity, we've been looking into this interlocking subversion in government. And in the course of it, we've been giving great stress to the Harry Dexter White case.
Now, what is your objective, or what is the committee's objective in looking into this? Does it have a long-range objective in going back into these operations, which happened 7 or 8 years ago, and bringing them to light now? Haven't they been brought to light at least piecemeal previously?
Well, Mr. Bell, I think that what the committee would like very much to do would be to determine, the pattern by which this infiltration was made possible, so that it could, A, expose the present infiltration, which there is reason to believe still exists, as well as the...
You think the same pattern may exist now?
There is reason to believe that. That's right. See, I call your attention, Mr. Bell, to the Bentley testimony. She said that there were 4 rings operating, and as far as we know, only 2 of them have been exposed. Now, that's not saying there are 2 rings still in government, but it certainly raises the possibility that there were 2 still in government.
Well, don't you think, Mr. Counsel, that the committee's time would be better spent on trying to ferret out those 2 rings than in going back into this testimony, which the FBI has had in its possession for 7 or 8 years?
Well, Mr. Bell, I don't think it's particularly the function of a Senate committee to ferret out individual communists in government. The prime responsibility of the committee...
Some of your colleagues don't seem to agree with you on that point.
Well, the primary responsibility of the committee, Mr. Bell, is to determine what legislation is going to be necessary to aid the Attorney General and other agencies to ferret out the communists still in government.
Isn't that the only justification for a committee hearing, legislative action?
Well, no. You see, you can't expect the Senate or the House of Representatives to act without facts. And one of the functions of an arm of the Senate, in this case the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, is to accumulate the facts and make them available to the Senate as a body so that it may then enter into legislation.
Mr. Lee.
Judge Morris, Igor Guzenko, the Russian code clerk who broke the Canadian atomic spy ring, is quoted today as saying that he would like to help break Soviet spy rings that are operating in Washington now. Does the subcommittee have any evidence that espionage activities are going on in Washington at this very time?
Well, Mr. Lee, what I'd like to point out on the Igor Grishenko case is this, that the Internal Security Subcommittee has nothing about what has no information about what Mr. Grishenko has told the United States government. We have read from time to time by Canadian authorities that everything he knows has been turned over to the United States government. However, the Internal Security Subcommittee does not have that information. From time to time, we have accumulated fragments of what must have been told to this government. For instance, in that August 1945 memorandum, which has been put into our record, a statement was made in there that Igor Grishenko, the former Soviet code clerk, had informed the United States government that the secretary of the then Secretary of State, Mr. Stettinius, was a Soviet agent. Now, that certainly is a fact that should be brought within the scope of our record. I mean, if Mr. Grishenko can give us sworn testimony to that fact, then we will certainly have more than we have now in our record. Now, that's just one thing. There are several other allusions to what Mr. Grishenko could tell the committee, and that's what we're trying to find out.
I wonder if you could explain what perhaps is the most dramatic moment of the Harry Dexter White case so far, the appearance of J. Edgar Hoover. Could you tell us the circumstances that led Mr. Hoover to break his self-imposed ban against public appearances before congressional committees?
Yes, I think that's an important question, Mr. Lee, because the Senator Jenner and all the senators on the committee were most reluctant to call Mr. Hoover. I think in the course, as the case was developing, there were several demands that Mr. Hoover be made available to give all possible testimony on the case because it was an important case. The committee asked Mr. Hoover, and he declined. He said he didn't think it was proper that he should give testimony. There's always been a great reluctance on his part, and as you know, Senator Jenner has been very reluctant to call him. Senator Jenner feels that there shouldn't be a precedent established. As soon as a congressional committee wants to know something, they call the source of much information Mr. Hoover. However, after a story was well circulated and rather persistently circulated, in fact, congressmen gave expression to it, that Mr. Hoover had been a party to an agreement whereby Mr. White would be kept in government, and therefore, in a certain way indicated that Mr. Hoover had entered into an agreement that was beyond the purview of his authority in order to restore what public confidence might be lost in Mr. Hoover, Senator Jenner thought it'd be best to renew his request and to stress with particularity that aspect of the case. And only then did Mr. Hoover accede to the committee request that he appear.
He was never subpoenaed, was he, Mr. Morris?
Oh, no.
Does the subcommittee have any intention of inviting Supreme Court Justice Clark to appear? He seems to be the enigma man of this controversy at the moment.
Well, Senator Jenner and Senator John Marshall Butler of Maryland had an exchange during our last session, which made very clear the subcommittee's point on that score. Senator Butler raised the question, well, should not Justice Clark be called to give what he knows about this, because after all, he was one of the witnesses to this particular transaction. Senator Jenner took the position that if and when Judge Clark is going to be called, the committee should have before it all the facts. In other words, you see, we now have begun the Harold Glasser case, the Frank Coe case. There'll be many others. So instead of extending an invitation to Justice Clark, if the committee will do that, which hasn't been determined yet, Senator Jenner thought it would be best to wait until all the facts are in, and then if and when he's called, he would be able to make only one appearance.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Morris, in her sworn testimony, Elizabeth Bentley, and in his sworn testimony, I believe, Whitaker Chambers, named 37 government employees who were connected with the Soviet espionage organization. Now, none of those people has been indicted or convicted. Now, how do you explain such an extraordinary thing?
Not necessarily
for espionage.
Them,
no. Two were convicted, but not for espionage.
That's right.
For perjury. Remington and Hiss were convicted for perjury.
In the first place, obtaining convictions for espionage is a very difficult thing. And it's almost one of the hardest crimes to prove because of the stealth employed by the people engaged in it. And as you know, we've had only two outstanding witnesses. No, there were more than that. You have Harry Gold and Mr. Greenglass. They have also been witnesses. But the scarcity of witnesses to overt acts of espionage has really been possibly the principal handicap to bringing about more prosecutions. I would point out, however, there seems also to have been a certain timidity with respect to many of these things. For instance, from time to time, I think it was in the Brothman case, my recollection of the Brothman case, was one of the people working with Elizabeth Bentley. I think Roy Cohn, who was the assistant Irving Sapol in New York, brought about a conviction, even though at the time he had only one witness and a cardboard piece of paper. And still, because of the persuasiveness of Miss Bentley and because of the supplementary corroborative evidence that was adduced at the trial, I think that an indictment and conviction of Brothman was obtained.
Well, aren't we endangering our civil liberties by practically convicting these people of espionage simply by accusation and not by trial?
Well, who's convicting of that, Mr. Spivak?
Well, I mean, even take the case of, for example, take the case of White. Now, a great number of people who were unsympathetic to White wonder about the charges against him without a trial. In 1948, he was brought before a grand jury, but he wasn't indicted. Now, and yet he's been branded before all the world as a spy and cannot defend himself. Now, there are some 17 others, or 37 others, who have been accused but haven't been tried and haven't been convicted.
Well, Mr. Spivak, the committees are very mindful of that, and you raise a point that is very, very troublesome, apart from the civil liberties point of view. Now, what the committees are trying to do, particularly in the White case and in the other cases, I mean, White a little more so because the man is dead. Now, before the Internal Security Subcommittee will have a decision on that particular case, it will weigh every bit of the evidence that is now available to the committee. Now, its conclusion will not naturally have the same force of an indictment or a conviction. But you say, since the man is dead, it'll probably be just as effective. Well, the committee is going to be very mindful of that, and I'm sure that it will come to a very, very equitable conclusion and will take into consideration all the evidence.
Well, what worries me is the grave danger we're running into by accusing people and not being able to convict them. Now, they've had a great many years to get evidence on these people. Why is it impossible to get evidence on these people?
Well, it's not
sufficient
accusation.
Sufficient to prove it in a court of law.
It's not accusation, Mr. Spivak. It's sworn testimony introduced into the record. Now, the net result, I grant you, is that it's an accusation. But the Internal Security Subcommittee and the other committees of Congress have the duty to bring these facts out and to bring them into the record by way of aiding in the legislation that's going to remove this problem. Now, it's true that it's conceivable that somebody may be damaged, some innocent person may be damaged. But I think that's one of the hazards in the work, and the committees have a tremendous responsibility on that score.
Well, now, has the statute of limitations expired on all those who may have been involved in this White espionage business?
Well, I don't believe so. See, in other words, it's not the function of the committee to determine whether or not indictments can be handed down. But in the course of watching all this evidence come through the committee, the point is often raised. Has the statute of limitations run against these crimes? As you may know, the Internal Security Act of 1950 has extended the statute of limitations for espionage to 10 years. I think previously, my understanding is that previously the statute of limitations was 3 years, but that's been extended by the Internal Security Act of 1950.
Is it not a fact
Mr. Lee,
wiretapping and immunity laws advocated by Mr. Brownell were now on the books, a great many people who are not now in jail would be convicted spies?
Well, naturally, I don't know firsthand, Mr. Lee, but I would say most definitely.
You favor those laws, do you, sir?
I realize that wiretapping evidence, Mr. Lee, is evidence that hasn't long been employed by our form of government. But after all, remember that this government has never been in danger of being overthrown. Never in all its history has such a threat to our free institutions existed as is now posed by the Soviet threat. And that we have a very extraordinary enemy, an enemy whose nature is something that our free institutions has never experienced before, and that we are making a natural readjustment in our own system of protecting ourselves. And for that reason, even though it may not be my function as counsel to the committee, I should think it would be necessary, and naturally it should be used very, very guardedly and cautiously.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Morris, is the Senate Internal Security Committee accumulating evidence, however slight, which reasonably could be said to lead toward the conviction of some one or more individuals for espionage?
Oh, I think so, very definitely.
That could flow from the hearings you're having.
That's right, particularly particularly with respect to some of the witnesses who have testified in executive session.
About which there has been no publicity as to now.
That's fragmentary.
Mr. Bell.
Judge Morris, I want to explore another thing along the lines of civil rights. Does your committee have access to the loyalty files of government employees?
No, we don't have access in the sense that is there an exchange of loyalty files between any branch of the government. I think the question was raised last week, Mr. Bell, and I'll bring it right out here now. The committee has obtained from time to time certain reports, and the way it obtained it is it knows all the circumstances, and it has it in its files. And if those files aid the committee in its interrogation of witnesses, the committee feels it is a justified use of those particular
Now, you say things. Certain reports. What kind of reports are you talking about in that case?
Well, I mean, you asked the question, Mr. Bell. I think there was a reference last week to a...
In reference to this Solomon Adler case, where you put excerpts, at least, from the loyalty files into the committee record.
And concealing the identity of the...
There is a presidential order against your having access to such files. Isn't that true?
Well, no, I don't think that's the fact, Mr. Bell.
Well, I think that order still stands.
Well, I think the order means that there is an order that none of them are going to be turned over to the congressional committees, unless through a cabinet member. Now, after all, isn't what Mr. Brownell did the other day, isn't that the making available, at least before a congressional committee, of evidence that have been in loyalty files?
I don't know whether that was in the loyalty file. I assume that was in the FBI file, which is separate and distinct from the loyalty file in the department. I think you got this information from a departmental loyalty file, which, under existing orders, as I understand it, should be inviolate as far as Congress is concerned, unless the president gives specific authority for you to take that information.
Well, the point, Mr. Bell, the point of the committee is that the committee has come into possession of certain files, and the information that the committee possesses is information that's going to aid it in its investigations. And from time to time, there's an allusion. They're never introduced into the record, Mr. Bell. From time to time, there may be an allusion to some of these things.
Didn't you introduce part of this into the record
No.
in the Adler case?
No.
It was only an allusion.
There was an allusion. As I say, the sources of evidence and the sources of information in the files were discreetly concealed.
Well, do you think the committee ought to have authority to go into those files? Couldn't it find a lot of information in those files?
Well, that's very true, Mr. Bell, and I think many of these things should be brought out, which brings out my basic approach to this whole thing, if you'd like to have it. And that is, I think that Republicans and Democrats, progressives and liberals, everybody should at this point join forces to bring all these secrets that have been lurking beneath the surface out into the public view. In that way, we can eliminate the present subversives, and we can clear up those who may have been involved in the past no longer involved. So I think these things all should be brought out. At the same time, Mr. Bell, I think that any committee undertaking to deal with loyalty files has a tremendous responsibility, that something in there is going to come out and do damage to innocent people. So if they are going to be used, they should be used with the utmost caution, the utmost discretion, and with the greatest of care.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Morris, do you think that as a result of your investigation, you're going to bring out information of sufficient importance to indict anybody who was mixed up in any of this business?
Well, it's not the function of the committee, Mr. Spivak, to bring out information that will indict. It's the function of the committee to bring facts into the record that will, A, enable the Senate and the House of Representatives to effect legislation which will solve many of these pressing problems. Now, there have been many good recommendations that have proceeded from these hearings, particularly the ones on subversion. And as you know, Mr. Brownell has come forward with a recommendation that wiretap information be made legal. He also has made a recommendation that immunity be granted to witnesses. Now, some of these gentlemen who parade before the committee and invoke the Fifth Amendment in connection with the various questions asked by the committee, they are the repository of secrets that would help the country.
Well, you get a wiretap law, are you going to be able to use the old information that was gotten through wiretap on some of these people who...
In other words, if a wiretap law will be passed, will it be effective in the past?
Possible to use that information, yes.
Well, that's technical question in the law that I better not answer now. I'm not sure.
May I change the subject for just a second?
Sure.
What did J. Edgar Hoover prove in his testimony before your committee that it was of sufficient importance for him to take the risk of losing his job if the Democrats come back into power in 1956? Or don't you think he's taking that chance?
Well, I'm sure that Mr. Hoover acted without any consideration whatever of what his whether he was risking his job or not. I felt that he realized that a challenge had been made to the integrity of his office. And in addition, he had the facts that would solve a very pressing problem before the country. And I'm sure that he shed every other consideration and acted accordingly.
When you say
I'm afraid, gentlemen, we're going to have to wind it up right there. Our time has run out. Thank you very much, Mr. Morris, for being with us.